The committee will come to order. There's a quorum, right?
Yep.
Okay, thanks. What I want to have you do is just say a little bit about yourself, and so we have an idea of what you're liking and what and things that you want to do. So, you want to start with Dave?
My name is David Musilevich. I work for House DFL Research. I've been assigned to the Agriculture Committee for many, many years. I think 1993 was my first session.
I'm Dave Olin, State Representative, District 1A, northwest corner of the state. I was on finance last year, so now I am on policy.
I'm Gary Dean Erdahl, and this is my seventh year on this committee.
I'm Terry Morrow. This is my second term on this committee.
Steve Draskowski from Wabasha. This is my kind of my second term on the committee, yes.
Al Doty from 12B, which is most of Morrison and south and eastern Crow Wing counties. Second term on this committee and also on Ag Finance.
Andrew or A.J. Dewar, committee administrator. This is my first term on the committee. I'm looking forward to working with Cheryl Tremba and the rest of the members.
I'm Representative Mary Ellen Otremba, and I live on a farm, and I think I've been on the Ag Committee for 12 or 13 years.
I'm Mary Larson, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Representative Tim Faust, my second year on this committee, and from District 8B, which is Kanabic and southern half of Pine County, a little bit by Sandy County.
I'm Ron Szymanski from District 18, in McLeod County and Meeker County, and this is my third year on the Ag Policy Committee.
I'm Kent Deacon, District 2A, that's northwest Minnesota. It's Norman, Minoman, Becker, Polk, and Clearwater counties, and this is my second term on the committee.
I'm Jim Thury from House Research, and I'm looking forward to another really good year working with all of you. For the people, right?
I'm Colby Sullivan, also with the nonpartisan House Research Department. I work on agriculture and bioenergy issues. This is my fourth session, and I've been with the Ag Policy Committee since day one.
Mike
Scholl, I'm with Republican Caucus Research, and just recently came from Ohio, so looking forward to it.
Thank you. Okay, then we'll kind of get going with our committee meeting. Today we'll have the Office of the Legislative Auditor report on the Department of Agriculture. So, welcome to my committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Cecile Furkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor responsible for the Financial Audit Division. We're here today to talk about an audit report that we recently issued about the Department of Agriculture. Before we get into the details of that, I'd like to just give you a little overview of the Legislative Auditor's Office, Financial Audit Division, what work we do. In the Financial Audit Division, we spend quite a bit of our time auditing the state of Minnesota's financial statements and doing some other financial statement audits, including the retirement systems, the dome, the mosquito control district, and the state fair. In addition to that, we have some regularly scheduled audits of the constitutional officers. We do those every 2 years. That'll be included in our round of audits in the upcoming months. Beyond that, we examine state agencies on a rotational basis based on our assessment of the risks inherent in their financial activity. And what we look at in those audits is their internal controls that they've designed for their financial operations and their compliance with legal provisions, statutes, state policy, and departmental provisions, their compliance with those provisions through the period that we're looking at. So that was the nature of this audit. It was an audit of the department's internal controls over its financial operations and its compliance with legal provisions. So with that kind of lead in, I'm going to turn over to one of our audit managers to discuss the audit.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brad White. I'm a financial audit manager with the Legislative Auditor's Office. We conducted a 3-year control and compliance audit of the Department of Agriculture. In addition to receipts, the audit focused on the department's administrative spending on personnel and payroll, travel, and employee use of purchasing cards and cell phones. We concluded that controls generally were adequate over receipts and most aspects of payroll. However, we found weak controls over travel, credit cards, and cell phones. Out of the 15 reported control and compliance findings, 7 were focused on travel. We found that the department needs to improve controls by better controlling mileage claims to ensure distances are reasonable, having employees turning claims more timely to avoid additional employer FICA taxes, comparing budgeted to actual trip costs, and improving the coordination of any personal travel that might be combined on a state-paid business trip. But the more challenging finding involved a rather unique concern. The department's marketing and promotions are exempted from state travel rules. Realizing that typical travel rules don't apply, we encountered as auditors some costs we typically don't see. First-class airfare incurred by the commissioner and marketing staff, payments for bus tours, and reimbursements for group dinners. Considering the travel exemption, we felt that the department needs to develop alternative controls to control and establish parameters surrounding those costs. In another finding, we noted that several staff in the department, including the commissioner, are actively involved in outside organizations. Those organizations are many times willing to sponsor some of the travel costs. We felt there was a need to better control the coordination of those sponsored costs to ensure the state is only paying for its appropriate share. And finally, we found that travel benefits, such as frequent flyer miles, were being held in personal accounts that were not being reported to the department's finance office as required by Minnesota statutes. Those miles certainly are state assets and can be used to defray future travel costs for the department. In the area of personnel and payroll, we had 5 concerns. One important finding involved the need for the department to document its authorization and documentation for explaining the transferring of over $4 million of payroll expenses between programs and between funds. A second finding reported the need to better control the approval and justification for incurring overtime to both hourly and salaried workers. Finally, we felt there was a need for improved control over employee use of credit cards. Providing employees with credit cards has an increased risk. Unless the department can effectively deter that risk or diminish that risk by running key reports showing credit card limits and decline credit card transactions. And they also need to effectively document that charges on those credit cards were for a public purpose. In response to the report findings, department management has developed some very specific corrective actions to improve those controls over those finance areas. Madam Chair and members, those are the report highlights, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Pelz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first one, you brought up several points. The first one, I don't know if my ears were hearing slow or you were talking fast, but I didn't catch that. Would you repeat the first one, please?
Finding number one in the report?
Yes.
Finding number one is a situation involving travel requirements. The department has a travel exemption, meaning they don't have to follow the typical state travel rules that most executive branch agencies are required to follow. Because of that exemption, we felt there was a need to define and develop alternative criteria to kind of put some parameters or constraints around those costs. Again, we were encountering situations where first-class airfare was being paid for. We typically don't see that in our state agency travel budget, but we were seeing it here in this particular situation. Again, they had the statute that exempted them from following the typical requirements.
Thank you again. In finding 9, they move $4.6 million between accounts and the sales payroll. Is that an unusual thing, or is that something that normally happens and is not a big deal?
Representative, Madam Chair, that is common across state government. We do find that departments needs to manage the funds that come in a lot of times from federal sources or other outside sources, and it might involve a situation where a cost is split between two different funds or cost centers. So it is not uncommon. I guess what is concerning here is that we didn't find documentation to explain in particular cases why they were transferring the money.
Representative,
do
you want to follow up?
Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you have no reason to believe that anything bad happened. They didn't do anything wrong. It's just they didn't make the paper trail as good as you would have liked it to be.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. Yes, we needed documentation so that outsiders like ourselves as auditors can have an understanding of why they're removing the funding. We found in cases where they did part of the time have that documentation on hand. The other half of the sample items we've looked at, they did not have that information available to us. So they could be playing games. They could be shuffling money around inappropriately. We do not think that's been happening. It's just a documentation concern.
Representative Erdahl?
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just noticed that the responses from the department are in the back, and I'll read through them. But does the department or agencies, when you do these reports, do they have to address the concerns that you have? Do they do that internally? Do they have to, or does it require, you know, some other authority to require that they do?
Madam Chair and Representative, it can vary based on the type of finding. If it's a policy question that's not clearly defined in a particular policy, it might involve require involving the management and MMB, Department of Finance, to get some clarification there. Most of the time, the procedural processing that goes on to control financial spending is internal to the department. We try to see controls in place. We don't try to specify particular requirements or options. We give them flexibility to try to address the control. So many times there are alternatives they can take to achieve the same control assurance.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief follow-up. What happens if they just say they won't do it?
Madam Chair, may I address that? And Representative, we don't have any enforcement ability to, there's no consequence from our office about complying or not complying with our recommendations. Most agencies take our recommendations seriously, take our concerns seriously, and we believe the Department of Agriculture has done that as well and plans to implement changes in these areas. The Department of Finance does monitor on a quarterly basis how agencies are doing with implementing recommendations, but you know, sometimes when we come back to do an audit a few years later, we find that sometimes they're implemented and sometimes they aren't implemented, and all we can do is re-recommend it at that point.
Representative Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering about the travel exemptions. If what was the reason for that? It's the only agency that didn't have the parameters around it and the, you know, the restrictions that other agencies did. And if there was a reason for that, and if there should be some kind of different parameters set for them.
Madam Chair, I believe it was intended to bring down barriers that might be out there to traveling, maybe distances like to Asia or other parts of the world. We're not sure. Ultimately, the exemption was put into place a while ago. It is parallel with an exemption provided to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. They've got a similar exemption for their trade office. Again, I believe intended to kind of break down other barriers that might be there and give them some flexibility in incurring costs that might not otherwise be usual.
Okay. And so it sounds like there is a justification for an exemption, or at least different parameters or different types of standards maybe being set here.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative, we certainly aren't saying that the department still needs to be held to the standards that are set for state government, but we also don't think that the exemption was meant to imply that any costs were acceptable, but that there may be a need to expand beyond. And we've discussed internally, too, there certainly may be situations where first-class airfare is a justified expense, maybe the length of a trip, or maybe you're traveling with someone that also is traveling first class. But we believe that the department ought to define what their limits are and what their expectations are if first class is going to be incurred, and what those parameters are and other types of travel expenses. Because they do still have to, in our view, be accountable that these expenses are reasonable and necessary for their mission.
Thank you.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize that the time since the response from Ag Department is barely more than a month, but I also imagine that you're awaiting that response and you've looked at those responses. Can you at this time state that if they do the things that they said here, that, hey, great job, they fixed pretty much anything serious that you found?
Madam Chair, Representative, I feel that would be going out on a limb for our office to do that. We do like audit evidence to support a statement like that. So I you know, that would be something we'd have to wait and see until we can go in and test.
Would you say, though, that they have at least responded to everything which you found? Did they didn't skip anything, I guess, is really the question.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might be asking a question that's maybe difficult to answer, but I haven't read enough of these. I'm still too new here to know whether this is a fairly good report, a couple minor things to fix. Oh, my gosh, things have fallen apart at the Department of Ag. Are you able to characterize this in comparison to other audits you've done of other agencies and give us a sense of the severity of the concerns here?
Madam Chair and Representative, there are some concerns here that we feel are important and serious. Statutory noncompliance with the frequent flyer miles is something that, you know, at some point the legislature felt that was a very important issue and wrote it into statute about the reporting requirements of agencies. And we saw that not only not being followed, but not being known and not being understood that there was a statute that addressed that. Some of the things about payroll oversight, obviously a payroll is a material area within the department, and oversight as the department uses electronic time reporting, we believe is an important issue about a very material part. We think that their need to develop their own limits and standards for their travel and marketing areas, we feel that's important because we feel it is an area that could be abused. We feel it's important because of the unique nature of the sponsorships where other businesses are sponsoring aspects of travel and because of the potential there where there could be a conflict of interest with the business and the department's need to control those costs. We feel that that's an important issue. Is this the most serious report we issued this year? No, it's not. It isn't the most serious weaknesses that we have found, but we do feel that there are important issues in this report that the department needs to address.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could just a small follow-up.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I guess I would ask, perhaps we could ask the Department of Ag to, next time it comes or when it comes before this committee, to report back on its commitment to following the recommendations that are set out here in the audit report. That might be one step that Representative Doty and others have been asking in terms of making sure that these things actually are followed.
And I think that was what one of my questions of how often do you re-audit or whatever. Do you have a knowledge of that, or do we have to ask for that again?
Madam Chair, we, in the Financial Audit Division, we generally determine our schedule, and it's based on a variety of attributes that we look at in terms of determining the risk that an entity has. We have over 150 different entities under our jurisdiction, and we can maybe get to 20 of them a year. We have limited resources, and we're very diligent about how we deploy those resources within the office. Another aspect of when we would again audit would be that there needs to be an implementation that's sustained over some period of time for us to look at. So we need some period of transactions, some period of compliance for us to look at to know whether or not there was just a quick fix or whether or not there's truly been a change in that control environment and in that compliance. So we probably, the earliest that we would get back to this would be a couple of years.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for the testifiers? If not, thank you. Someone from the department is coming up and going to give us the good news. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Quinn Cheney. I'm the Legislative Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee today. We very much appreciated the professional review that the Office of the Legislative Auditor did of the department, and it's always useful to have someone come in from the outside and look and give you some guidance on how you can improve things. I think we certainly have some areas where they identify that we can do better, areas where we can more clearly document our expenditures and just do a little bit tighter job on that sort of on the documentation thing. We have set up a plan to work with the Office of the Minnesota Management and Budget Office, still getting used to saying that, Department of Finance, to provide them with some quarterly reports on how we are proceeding with the with our goals to implement some of the new policies as recommended by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I also brought Steve Ernest along, and he can identify a few of the areas that the auditors identified. Maybe we could just provide a couple of responses on some of the findings. One of the areas that they identified that I would like to comment on is the area finding number, I think it was one, with respect to the promotional travel that we've done and that exemption that that was discussed. Our department, division of marketing and promotion, does quite a bit of foreign travel, and with the goal of going overseas and in other states to sell our state and our state's products. So it's a little bit different than the type of travel that one would do just to attend a conference, because you are doing a little more salesmanship. And so the exemption that is in place is similar to what was at the Department of at the travel office, indeed, for the same purpose. And as you know, several years ago when those agencies were split, it used to be that all of the ag promotion, international promotion, was all together in one place, and then when that office went away, some of those responsibilities came to our department, so along with that exemption. And Steve can provide some more information on some of the other areas.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Steve Ernest, Financial Management Director at the Department. Yeah, an example, our exemption is just for promotional activities, so it's not for the regulatory activities or anything else. And I guess an example of why we might need that, when the federal government travels overseas, for example, to China, they have a per diem of $95 if you go to Beijing and $130 a day if you go to Shanghai. So there are costs there that are certainly outside of any state contracts that we would be able to reimburse an employee for. We just wouldn't be able to go if we couldn't make some exceptions for those cases. One point on the first class travel, I don't think you mentioned that. We did have some flights taken that were first class flights. We didn't pay for first class flights, because we have a couple people, including the commissioner, that do travel enough, either from personal or work, to get a higher status in the frequent flyer miles program. They occasionally will bump them up to first class. And when we looked at those, we saw that they were just free upgrades that we didn't pay for the first class ticket, because in every case I saw, it was only one direction. Either going there, they got the first class, or coming back, they got it, but not vice versa. And we were unaware of the requirement to report specific frequent flyer miles, and we are doing that now. We have not found an ability to, since we use Northwest to separate, for most of our travel we use Northwest, to separate a personal frequent flyer account and a work one. Their policy is not to issue two accounts to one person. What we did go back and check on was to make sure that all the miles that were earned on state travel were still in the account or had been used, which was the case sometimes, that some of them had been used to already get state tickets free for us. So it wasn't like any state dollars were at risk, but we actually got some benefit by them taking the frequent flyer miles, and then we got some free tickets out of that. Going forward, we'll be tracking that more closely to keep track of it. On the payroll changes, we are also implementing a new electronic time tracking system. What happens is sometimes if an employee is working on a certain project and it's maybe requires a match between a federal grant and state general fund dollars, they'll just track their time all to their standard general fund funding source. And then we have to go back and correct, well, that should have been 50-50. Well, we were doing a lot of those, and I think going forward we plan to settle up each quarter and do a lot fewer of them, because we have a more systematic database to track the activity a person is working on, and we'll correct the funding strings less frequently, but because people's days vary, whether they're inspecting, doing a dairy activity or a non, you know, some other kind of food inspection, it's a mix of time, and we try to get it accurate, and we're going to try to do less corrections and just more strategic corrections. I guess, you know, another thing on reimbursement for mileage traveled, that was another finding that wasn't mentioned as much in the presentation, but we didn't do as good of a job as we should on tracking local miles. So the auditors came in and looked at the city-to-city names on the expense report, calculated the mileage between those cities, and there were miles in addition to that, and we just need to document that. Well, they went to that city and then they went beyond it or out in the country or around somewhere else, and we just, I think, documentation, with the proper documentation, there were no miles that were inappropriate. We didn't feel that we had overpaid any miles. I think if you read the report, you will notice that it mentioned that all our previous findings from previous audits have been resolved. So that's the first thing they do when they start an audit, is to say, is anything unresolved or we're not unresolved, so they went forward.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the department, I just want to say thank you for taking the report seriously and making the changes to address any of the concerns and also implement the auditor's recommendations for improvements. One of the questions that I have is on the usage of credit cards. Are there proper limitations in place and proper protections in place in the event there would be fraud, that we minimize the risk to the state?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, the cards have built-in limits, and you're not supposed to be able to use it, for example, to purchase meals. Occasionally, things slip through, which are violations, like if someone stays at a hotel, they get room service. When you check out, and MMB does, in their travel policy, encourage state employees to use purchasing cards if they have them, and it's limited. In our agency, there may be a dozen, to use them for travel things, because it does, in a way, provide a better, quicker documentation of certain expenses like the lodging. The meals are separate because different people are under different bargaining agreements, their union contracts. So we have to go through and look at each individual reimbursement request for those. If someone checked out and had room service and paid for it with their purchasing card, they would be in violation of the state policy. But what they're supposed to do if they get room service is ask for two bills, pay, you know, if they want to pay for the lodging with the purchasing card, they can pay that. If they can't pay the room, they'd have to pay that with their own credit card or cash, and then ask for us to reimburse that so that we can check that it meets their contract limits. So we had a few of those that were violations, but what we did was we asked them to pay us back with a personal check what they shouldn't have charged on the credit card, then fill out the expense report form, then have us pay them back the money. It just gets to be a lot of paperwork, but it's just all in an effort to document that we're meeting the policies.
Representative Samantha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ernest, finding number 7 talks about late submission of travel expenses and so forth that incurs some tax liability. Have you put remedies in place such that the expense reimbursements are submitted in a timely manner?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. We are... the main thing we're doing is basically bugging people to get their expense reports in on time. That's all we can really do. The federal guideline, it's not a federal law, it's not in federal code, it's a guideline, and it says that it's the employee or the traveler's responsibility to report within a reasonable amount of time, usually 30 days, and that 30 days has been, or 60 days I guess it is, has been incorporated into our state computer system as the trigger where the tax will kick in, because that's what we consider a reasonable amount of time. I I think that some employees were thinking, well, you know, if I didn't get it in time, I'll pay taxes, and, you know, that's just my problem, I'll just pay taxes. And they weren't thinking, well, the state also has to pay the state side of the taxes. And so, you know, the auditor pointed out that there is that side of it too, and we did incur costs that are just out of our pocket. And so we are trying to remind people in general, and then in specific, if we know some people have traveled, we have an accounting officer assigned to each division, and they sign off on every trip before it's taken to say that money is available for the trip, so they know people are traveling, and that's what we can do.
Any other questions? Any other questions? Oh, Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking over the findings, I find 15 findings, and 15 times the department says they agree with the recommendation and then go on to say how you'll implement that. Like Representative Hamilton, I'd like to commend you for getting right on it. The question is, are any of these, in your opinion, going to cost us more to do the right way than it was costing us before? Are these particularly difficult to implement, or we're going to be okay here without spending a lot of extra money?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, the only situation I can think of where we probably will institute a restrictive agency policy so that we don't spend more time on it than it's worth is if there's an employee who travels rarely, once a year, maybe once every couple of years, it would not be worth our time probably to track that person's frequent flyer miles, because they probably will never earn enough to get a free ticket for us, or it would take a long time. What we could do in that case is just tell them that they can't take frequent flyer miles for their trips, thereby preventing them from building them up on their card. That law, we can require them to report to us if they do, if they accidentally do, or for the ones that do travel a lot and we do want to monitor it and do know that we'll get some value out of it. But ultimately, there probably are ways that people could hide that from us. And our easiest way to see that is if they turn in their boarding pass and it says has their frequent flyer number on it, we can see that they reported the trip for the frequent flyer mile program. But you know what, there could be a situation where someone violated that. I mean, ultimately it's the violation of that statute would be the individual's violation, that they took something of value that they earned through their position that they shouldn't have.
Okay. Are there any other questions? As long as you're there, we'll take time now to do the overview of the Department of Ag.
Madam Chair, we just have a video to show for the department overview. That was what your staff person requested. And several of you have probably seen the video already when you, several of you went on the tour with the department, at the department with the Ag Finance Committee. So I'm sorry if this is somewhat of a repeat, but hopefully you haven't all seen it.
It's always nice to hear it again.
I'm Gene Hugeson, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Agriculture is the foundation of Minnesota's economy. From its days of sod-busting pioneers to today's diverse state, dominated by a world-class metro area, times have certainly changed. But there has been one constant. That's the importance of agriculture in Minnesota. One of every five Minnesota workers has a job that is directly or indirectly related to agriculture. And it's the role of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to make sure our rich tradition continues as a provider of the highest quality food to people around our country and around our world. Over the next several minutes, you'll get an inside look at the department, find out how we play a pivotal role in agriculture from farm to table, and also meet some of the great people that work so hard to protect and improve agriculture in our state. Welcome to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Minnesota agriculture has always been an important part of our culture and our economy. Even as the Twin Cities and other urban centers around the state have become home to the majority of Minnesotans, agriculture remains an important industry that supports our quality of life. For more than 100 years, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has been there each step of the way. Based in St. Paul, our mission is to enhance Minnesotans' quality of life by ensuring the integrity of our food supply, the health of our environment, and the strength of our agricultural economy. MDA services start before the crop even goes into the ground. We help ensure that farmers have quality seed and animal feed so that the final product is also high quality. The MDA also provides a long list of services directly to Minnesota farmers, like risk management education and technical support for farmers making the transition to organic and sustainable agriculture. The department continues to provide services after the plants and animals leave the farm, with inspections of dairy and food processing facilities and international market development. Support continues all the way to the consumer level, with services like grocery store inspections, food safety education, plant nursery inspections, and the popular Minnesota Grown program, which helps consumers find the freshest, locally grown foods around the state. All these services can be divided into two categories, regulation and promotion. And that's how the department is split up, between our regulatory and non-regulatory divisions. Regulatory divisions include dairy and food inspection, pesticide and fertilizer management, plant protection, and laboratory services. Let's briefly take a look at the role of each of these divisions. Dairy and Food Inspection Division employees work to protect the integrity of Minnesota's food and animal feed supply. They help farmers, processors, and retailers keep their foods wholesome, and they help prevent the problems that can cause foodborne illness. Every dairy farm, feed mill, pet food manufacturer, grocery store, convenience store, and food processing facility in the state is inspected for quality, conditions, labeling, and sanitation.
The complexity of the inspection process has really changed over even the last 5 to 10 years. It's gone from just making sure that the floors, walls, and ceilings are clean to really looking at the process, the whole system of production.
Along with inspecting thousands of businesses across Minnesota, the Dairy and Food Division staff investigates reports of food contamination. These reports can come directly from our inspectors and product testing, or from investigations into human illnesses by our partners at the Minnesota Department of Health. The Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division enforces state laws dealing with the sale, use, and disposal of agricultural inputs such as fertilizers and pesticides. We monitor the state to make sure that pesticide products are used properly and don't have a harmful impact on the state's resources.
Pesticides are necessary for food preservation and food safety. We use them in urban environments. They're used in hospitals. Sanitizers and disinfectants, for example, are pesticides.
When there are allegations of misuse, the staff conducts investigations and imposes penalties when evidence supports them. We also work with farmers to continue an environmentally friendly approach to protect water and soil quality. The MDA is responsible for best management practices, or BMPs. These are voluntary practices, like planting grass buffer strips next to waterways, used by producers to protect ground and surface water quality. Our Plant Protection Division regulates and provides services intended to protect Minnesota's agricultural crops and native plant species. we inspect plant materials and commodities for export, certify, inspect, and regulate the nursery and honeybee industries in the state. We also protect the state's fields and forests from invasive pests. Two invasive insect pests the MDA closely monitors are gypsy moth and emerald ash borer. Employees also work to stop the spread of noxious weeds and plant diseases like soybean rust and sudden oak death.
We're a major soybean producing state. We're a major corn and wheat state. And by keeping out exotic pests that threaten those crops and our forests, preserves hundreds of millions of dollars worth of the Minnesota's economy.
All of these divisions, plant protection, pesticide and fertilizer management, and dairy and food inspection, are assisted by our laboratory services division. The MDA lab is co-located with the Minnesota Department of Health's lab next door to the Freeman Building in St. Paul. While the two departments share space, the lab's functions vary greatly. The MDA lab is split up into two areas, biology and chemistry. The scientist working within these areas examines samples of food, feed, dairy, fertilizer, pesticides, and water for a wide variety of tests. Without the services of the lab, many of the department's inspections, investigations, and certifications could not be done nearly as quickly and effectively.
One of the big reasons we're located in this facility right next to the new Freeman Building is because we need to be near our regulatory partners. We often have to make decisions on analysis to be performed, whether a result is sufficient enough to make their case.
The Laboratory Services Division also provides support to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration, Environmental Protection Agency, and other federal and state agencies. As mentioned, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture includes regulatory and non-regulatory services. Let's turn our attention to the non-regulatory side, which includes agricultural marketing services, agricultural development and financial assistance, and agricultural statistics divisions. The Ag Marketing Division works to strengthen Minnesota agriculture by developing and diversifying agricultural industries, markets, and products. MDA employees research and develop potential domestic and international markets for Minnesota's agricultural products. This is done through market research, market information, education, and technical assistance. The state's exports can be seen in countries like Japan, Mexico, China, Canada, and Taiwan.
Agriculture is twice as dependent on exports as the manufacturing businesses here in Minnesota. So it is critical for our 79,000 farmers that we're promoting agricultural exports around the world.
The Agricultural Marketing Services Division also works hard close to home. We operate the popular Minnesota Grown program, which helps connect Minnesotans who grow or raise specialty crops and livestock to those who want local products. The division also helps promote biofuels and provides development and technical help to livestock producers. The Agricultural Development and Financial Assistance Divisions oversee many programs designed to assist people all across the state, from rural Minnesota to the metro areas. A partial list of services includes water and soil improvement and conservation, sustainable agriculture, livestock support and development, and pest management.
We want to do it in a way that gets buy-in from people, have best management practices, examples out there, help people understand and want to make the change themselves versus somebody else coming in and demanding that they make the change.
One of the fastest growing sectors of the food industry is organic agriculture. MDA staff provides technical assistance and advice for farmers considering conversion to organic methods, certification, and marketing of organic crops and livestock. The division also has educational programs designed for all age levels. We oversee the biological control greenhouse for students, teachers, environmental educators, and others to learn more about insects. Financial assistance is a major component of this division. A wide variety of low-interest loans are available to farmers through the Rural Finance Authority, or RFA. The RFA partners with local lenders to provide affordable credit eligible farmers, including loans for beginning farmers and for agricultural improvements. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture's third non-regulatory division, Agricultural Statistics, is a good example of a state and federal partnership. The MDA has a cooperative agreement with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service to conduct hundreds of surveys every year and prepare reports covering virtually every aspect of U.S. agriculture, from weekly crop and weather reports to statewide agricultural production statistics.
We have a partnership with the MDA that allows us to meet the agricultural statistic needs of both state and the federal agency. And one, it reduced the cost to government for collecting the data, and we're not out asking the same producers the same questions at the same time. So it reduces their burden of reporting also.
Every 5 years, a comprehensive census of agriculture is conducted. This is the only source of consistent, comparable, and detailed agricultural data for every county in America. The ultimate goal for the staff is objective and unbiased statistics. The 450 employees of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture work hard each day to protect our food supply and natural resources while growing our agricultural economy. This is accomplished by the diverse roles of our regulatory and non-regulatory divisions. As we advance further into the 21st century, the MDA will continue to look for opportunities to help the state's agricultural sector adapt and thrive in the global marketplace. Meanwhile, we will continue to provide a consistently high level of service and protection to all those who grow, process, and consume Minnesota-grown foods. And as our motto reads, we at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture are partners with our producers and consumers, every Minnesotan, every step of the way, from the farm to your family.
That's it, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Christine Keel, Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Keel, Department of Veterans Affairs. And you do have a handout on the color by presentation that I'll go through to give you an overview of what our department does. The first slide just shows our quick higher-up chain of hierarchy. Since the Veterans Home joined us, we added a Deputy Commissioner of Veteran Health Care. This before was previously what was known as the Executive Director to the Veterans Home. When they joined us and we had the statutory changes last year, he became a Deputy Commissioner. And recently we've added two Senior Directors over our Programs and Services side and then one over Veteran Health Care as well. The next slide is just a few statistics. We have 410,000 veterans in Minnesota. We serve all 87 counties, and we work cooperatively with the county veteran service officers to deliver the services and benefits to the state's veterans. Even though this is a policy committee, I just want to give you a quick idea of what our budget is. Our FY08-09 biennial budget was $196.8 million. I did a little pie chart there so you can see how it breaks out from general fund in federal dollars. In our current biennial budget, like I said, the breakout state general fund miscellaneous special revenues, which is like license plate fees, federal funds, and fiduciary funds is what the nursing home residents pay if they have a part of pay for their stay at the nursing home. The next slide lists out our programs. I won't read through the list. I'll describe them each briefly in the following slides, but that lists all of the programs we have under our department. For all of the programs, we have just over 1,000 FTE, and how it breaks out is on the programs and services side, we have 80 FTE, and on the veteran health care side, we have 950. And then the central office that oversees the homes is 7 FTE. Our first program benefits, on the benefits side, I will start there. Our first program is the State Soldiers Assistance Fund.
This is the fund you're probably most familiar with because it is a direct emergency financial assistance to veterans. As you can see, some examples of the funding: shelter, utilities, optical and dental assistance, cash grants. And cash grants are if their hot water heater breaks or the furnace goes out. It's that emergency, quick, right now money that they can get to have those household items fixed. We also have special needs cases, which is something that's fairly new to that program, and that does not have an income or asset guideline tied to that program, but it is highly scrutinized, and it is for those, it's the program that fills the gap where somewhere the federal government doesn't supply or the other areas of the state children's assistance fund doesn't fund. Next is our link that phone line. As you can see, this is manned by MDVA staff during business hours. After business hours, it's transferred to crisis connection. If it is not a crisis phone call, they just take a message and send it to us. If it is a crisis phone call, they handle it and report that back to us. Since the beginning of LinkFet in August of 07, we've only had 3 crisis connection phone calls. We see that as positive, and we're hoping that because that number is so low, if there is a crisis where veterans are seeking help, maybe from the VA's 800 line. The next slide talks about the Veterans Preference Act that has to do with employment. This division makes sure that if a veteran feels he has been discriminated against or his veteran's preference rights not upheld in the hiring process, that division helps through that process. The next two programs, the state approving agency and our on-the-job training apprenticeship program, those are both 100% fully funded by federal dollars. Those programs are housed in our agency, but the 4 employees that we have, their salaries are fully funded as well as the travel expense and reimbursements for this program. The next slide, we have our higher education veterans program. This is also called the Campus Prep Program. This is a fairly new program. It's been in operation for 3 years. As the program's grown, we now have representation on 54 higher education campuses around the state. We only have 14 coordinators, so they are not on any one campus full time, but we do have a presence, like I said, on 54 campuses to assist veterans, current military members, and their families through the processes of higher education and financial aid. Next is the Minnesota GI Bill. This is not a federal bill. This is our own state GI education program. It is a last dollar in program, which means any student applying to this program, whether it be an undergrad, technical school, or graduate school, they have to have had all other funds expended, and this will fill the unmet need of any educational purposes, except for tools. So if you're in a trade program, because the federal government does not pay for tools under their federal GI Bill, this program will pay for tools. That's the one difference between us and the federal GI Bill as well. The next is the Surviving Spouse Dependent Education Benefit. This was expanded. It was formerly called the War Orphans Act or the War Survivors Act. Since we now allow spouses to use this, it was expanded and just changed the name. Unfortunately, we have not had any spouses take advantage of that program since we expanded it to fit them. Next is our federal claims assistance, and we have 2 offices, one in St. Paul and one in Fargo. As you can see, we help with claim development, submittal of evidence in support of a claim for service connection disabilities, pension assistance, and while we do not adjudicate the claims, the federal VA does that, we do help them, any veteran and or spouse, widow, may evaluate what decision came in from the VA and decide if maybe there's more evidence that we could submit to help increase that rating or get a different, more favorable outcome. Our next program is the Outreach and the Women Veterans Program. Those two are housed together, and as you can see, they go out and help minorities, females, and homeless veterans. In that program, we work closely with the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, MACV. They are really our go-to. They're a nonprofit. They aren't housed in our department, but they are really who we go to help with and for assistance with any homeless veterans. Next is our Tribal Veteran Service Officer Program. This has just been fully operational for slightly over a year, and we are located on all seven northern Minnesota tribes, except for Fond du Lac. The tribe has their own service officer paid with tribe dollars. And then we have two down here in the metro area that serve Upper and Lower Sioux and Mystic Lake and Sherville, or in Shakopee and Red Wing. The next program, we've titled it Minnesota Service Corps. It's our brand new program. It just passed last year and we received funding for it. CORE stands for Case Management, Outreach, Referral, and Education. This program is a partnership with Lutheran Social Services. As we introduced it last year, we were calling it the Case Manager Program. This program arose from the need that we were hearing from the calls and the emails from our link that line. When a veteran or a military member's family would call in and talk to our link, that people, we were discovering that it wasn't just that they were having a financial hardship at that one time. This was consistent. And when we would talk about what maybe is causing the financial hardship, we'd find out mom or dad, you know, whichever just got back doing a little bit too much drinking, or they've developed a gambling problem. And so this program comes in, they take a holistic approach, they look at all the avenues that could be causing different problems for the families, and that they get one caseworker assigned through Lutheran Social Services, and they work them through the system, whether it is a debt management counseling, family counseling, individual counseling, and we do that at no cost to the veteran. We've only had this program operational for 1 month, and in that 1 month we've had 19 veterans served. Six of them were for debt management and financial counseling, and three were for different mental health purposes. The next program is our state cemetery. Right now we just have one in Little Falls. We did receive legislative approval to seek to expand to northern a cemetery up in northern Minnesota. That's still going through the federal approval process. If we get approved for that, there is no state dollars into the development of the state cemetery, but there would be state dollars to pay for the staff to the cemetery. Our next program is our recently separated veterans program. If we get a DD 214 where a veteran has designated Minnesota as their home of record, they get a welcome home packet from us that talks about all these different programs and benefits we have to Minnesota's veterans. We refer them to their county veteran service officer and hope that they go in and visit them. And even if at the moment there isn't a need, that they get in there, get familiar, get to know. And if they need services 10, 15, 20 years down the road, or even a year, that they know about the services and they're educated on them. Our next program is the Enhancement Grant Program. This is strictly for county veteran service officers, and it is an open competitive grant process that is opened annually. And this past year, we had 145 applications from 63 different counties. We were able to award 101 different applications to the counties for a total of just over $1.45 million. Next, I'll turn to the other program in our department. It's the Veterans Homes. We have the five state-run Veterans Homes: Fergus Falls, Hastings, Laverne, Minneapolis, and Silver Bay. On this next slide, I put the average age and characteristics of, in each home or in each program area of the skilled nursing care and the domiciliary. And then the next slide, I just touch on what each home has. The first one is Fergus Falls. As you see, it's a newer home. It was established in 1997. We have 85 skilled beds. And it, within their complex, they have a community-based outpatient clinic, or a CBOC, and that's a federally funded clinic. That is not a state-run clinic for veterans. And the administrator is John Skillingstead, and the Fergus home just had a legislative audit report come in, too, with no findings, so we're very proud of Fergus for that. And then the next home is the Hastings home. This is different in the fact that it is not a skilled nursing care facility, it is a domiciliary or a boarding care facility. The goal of this place is not to have a veteran live there permanently, although some of them have been there for years. Our goal is rehabilitation, boarding care, get them back out into the community, give them a trade. So there's both rehab and CD counseling at that facility. The next one is the Laverne home. This is also a fairly new home, just done in 1994. This has the dementia and wander unit to it, and there's 85 skilled beds in nursing care. No domiciliary care is at this facility. The Minneapolis home is the oldest home. It used to be the old soldiers' home. As you can see, it was established in 1887. There's 341 skilled nursing care beds and 61 domiciliary beds. The Minneapolis home, just last year, if you remember in the news, had a condemned building, and that was where the domiciliary residents resided. So they are now using a wing of the residential skilled nursing care bed facility. We were approved from the federal government for demolition of that building because that is a life safety issue, and we're on the list to have a new building built. We will find out hopefully rather soon from the federal government if they're going to release the funds to build that new 100-bed nursing facility on the Minneapolis campus. Then lastly of the homes is Silver Bay. That is, again, a skilled nursing care facility. It is not a domiciliary facility, and there's 89 beds there, and that opened in 1991. It was transformed from an old school. And all of our nursing homes have waiting lists except for Hastings, and that's what the last slide represents, just what the current waiting lists are at each of the homes. So, Madam Chair, that's a very quick, brief overview, and I will take questions if you have any.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the report. Pretty comprehensive. We'd like to turn to two quick things. If I might, first on page 6. Under the enhancement grants.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking with one of the CVSOs who has been very active in putting up billboards and was then told he had to follow, I think, a state template for his billboard, and he had to put the state contact link, that phone number, not his own office phone number. Is that accurate? Because he would like to have the direct access. You think that's the more effective way to work with vets in his area?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, half and half. What we've told CVSO is that if you are going to be doing any advertising, we would like the link vet number displayed because it is an easy number to remember. If you're driving by or you see a van that has the van wrap, it's easy to remember 1-888-LINK-VET. However, we don't completely say no, you cannot put your county information on there. So some do have their county number, and then they'll also say, or link that, either or. There's a mixture of both, but it's not outright forbidden.
To follow up, Madam Chair, thank you. So he can go ahead and now start putting his number on there as well. Is that what I'm hearing, as long as he has a link that number?
Madam Chair, remember, that's correct.
And one final question, if I might, Madam Chair. I just spent $30 on tickets for a dinner to raise money for vans to get vets to VA facilities in the cities. I realize this is probably a federal issue, but I'd like to know if the Minnesota Department is doing anything to help facilitate the cost of vans and transporting vets from greater Minnesota to VA facilities.
Madam Chair, Representative Moore. Part of the grants does go to fund their transportation programs because we realize the county, that's a huge cost for them to do transportation. So some of the grants that were used, they've outright purchased vans with it, and some of them have reimbursed volunteer drivers mileage at the federal reimbursable rate to be competitive, because the federal government does reimburse that 0.41 cents a mile for transportation to and from medical appointments.
Are you, Madam Chair, for my follow-up, are you hearing, though, from your counties that the funding, whether it's reimbursement or like, is inadequate for getting vets from greater Minnesota to VA facilities?
Madam Chair, yes, we are hearing that from each of the counties, that transportation is probably one of their greatest needs.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Frequently in nursing home situations, people will put their name on the waiting list just in case, because they know that beds may not be available when the time comes, so they're on the waiting list. And so at any given nursing home, the number of people on the waiting list may not indicate a shortage of beds in that area. And so that's really what I'm asking here. When you notify someone that there is when a vacancy occurs and you call the top name on the list, what percentage of the time do they actually come in? How accurate is this 400 and some number that we have here for the true need for more beds?
Madam Chair, Representative, what I gave you is active waiting list numbers. We have inactive waiting lists that address your question of those who want to get on the list, so if something happens, then they can move to the active waiting list. I can get the inactive waiting list numbers for you if you like, but what I gave you today are the current, as of the end of December, active waiting list numbers.
No, I would not need an inactive list. I just wanted to see that this was indeed an active list.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Representative Foles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the federal money that comes in. It's about $31 million that comes in. You mentioned some programs here and there throughout the report where you said this is a federal program, and I'm assuming that these dollars are going to pay for those programs. This $31 million, is all of that going to those type of programs, or is there some money that just comes into the department that the department or us or somebody gets to decide what to do with, or is it all earmarked specifically for a specific program?
Ms. Keel.
Madam Chair, Representative Foss, it is all earmarked for a specific purpose. The federal dollars that we get for the SAA and the state approving agency and the OJT dollars, it is only to pay their staff time and their travel because they go out to all 87 counties and certify the schools. So the federal government knows that those schools have been certified to receive federal GI Bill money. And same with the other portion that we get in federal reimbursement is for the home, and that is strictly to pay for patient care. No, just general operating dollars.
Representative Yoza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing along with Representative Morrow's line of questioning a little bit. In my county of Meeker, they apparently don't transport someone to a facility unless they have more than one person to transport. Is that a county policy or is that your policy?
Ms. McKeel.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is more than likely a county policy because we don't put any policies in place. However, I wouldn't know if that's a federal VA policy. I'm going to look over to a CVSO here to see if he knows that to be. But to answer your question, we do not make that a department policy, no.
Hi. I'm Milt Schoen. I'm the Hennepin County Veteran Service Officer, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. There is no mandate with respect to transportation. Counties use, there are various models that are used. In greater Minnesota, in some cases, there are county-owned vans, and as Christine mentioned, there are some cases where volunteer drivers are used. The Disabled American Veterans has a transportation network. In the metro area, we rely on the transportation system. We've got light rail that runs to the VA. We've got a substantial transportation system. Oftentimes, the counties will have a van that takes people from the courthouse to the hospital or the community-based outpatient clinic, and because of the jurisdictions in the area, sometimes they may run more than one. They may have to run one to St. Cloud, and they may have to run one to Minneapolis. The veteran service organizations have been very helpful in supporting these programs. The charitable gaming receipts get donated, but there is no rule that applies statewide.
Okay, thank you. One more question, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. You said 400 some on your waiting list? Is that what it is?
Madam Chair, Representative Rudolph, for the Minneapolis one.
Okay, with this many people on waiting lists, I mean, is there a need for another veterans home?
Ms. Gill.
Madam Chair, Representative Rudolph, there's many counties who want a veterans home. The waiting list is so great at Minneapolis given the veteran population in the metro area. And right now we are having a study conducted it was a legislative requirement last year, to look at the Minneapolis campus to decide, do you build more at Minneapolis, put more money into Minneapolis, or do you close down Minneapolis, sell the land, and open smaller veterans' homes in one in, not one, but like one in each of the like north, south, east, west suburbs? It doesn't designate what suburb. Would that be a better way to deliver care to Metro veterans? We remain neutral. I will just say we remain neutral on where homes should be built. We will let the legislature decide, since you are responsible for funding any employees or tails to the nursing homes.
Madam Chair, so you're not going to ask for another veterans home today?
Madam Chair, Representative, we will not be asking for another veterans home today or tomorrow.
But maybe next week.
Maybe next week.
Representative Mishima.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Keogh, I have two distinct questions. One would kind of tie in with the Representative Doty's question on waiting lists for veterans' homes. At this point, are some of those veterans already in other care facilities that they're being taken care of, but they would prefer to get into a veterans' home?
Ms. Keel.
Madam Chair, Representative Schmancy. In some cases, that is true, that they are in their local community in one of those nursing homes, but they would just rather be in a veterans' home for the veterans' camaraderie that they get.
Madam Chair, may I pass the follow-up? If they are already in another, you know, nursing facility, would they rise higher on the waiting list, or do they have any preferential treatment in that circumstance?
Madam Chair, Representative Schmancy, no, we don't give preferential treatment. It is just basically first come, first serve.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I may ask my second question. Okay. On page 4, the Minnesota Veterans Affairs, the surviving spouse, dependent education benefits. And forgive me if I don't appear that I know the answer to this, but in the event that a veteran is totally disabled, does his spouse also qualify for educational benefits?
Madam Chair, Representative Schmancy, they do, just under a different program.
Thank you.
If I should call it a federal program, I'm sorry.
Representative Vistelsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Keel, page 5, you talked about the tribal veteran service officers. It strikes me that might be a small caseload. Did you say there's how many? 7? I'm trying to remember. Or maybe it's in here. How many tribal service veterans officers are there? And, of course, given the budget situation we're in, the question is that a function that could be integrated with the regular CVSOs?
Ms. Steele.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelsey, the tribal veteran service officers, we have a presence on each of the 7 northern Minnesota tribes, but there's one supervisor and then there's 2 in the metro, so for a total of 10 FTE in that program. The program has not been as successful to date as the department anticipated. It is a program that's only a year old, so we're going to give it more time to develop. We are working hard training and getting the CVSOs the appropriate backup to do the program, because the Native American population is the highest population that will not come out and seek benefits. Forking to them, trust issues, or with the federal VA, with us as a State Department. So getting their fellow Native Americans who are members of their tribes on their reservation, bringing this service to them, we feel is very important. Could it be combined? We did in the past have CVSOs, they still can do these same functions that the TVSOs provide. Again, we just heard feedback from the reservations and the different tribes. There was a trust issue there, not with any one CVSO or any one county. It was just kind of an in general summation of how they felt. And so we developed this program after seeing that the Fond du Lac Reservation, that their tribal veteran service officer that they had was working for them. Unfortunately, we haven't seen as much success with the program as we would have liked.
Representative.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up on that question, Ms. Keel. Could you kind of characterize maybe the caseload for, say, an average tribal veteran service officer relative to maybe an average county veteran service officer in a neighboring county or a contiguous county?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Drzewski, I don't have those figures with me. We do have them. We do track that, so I would be happy to follow up with you. That I just did not bring it with me today.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. Another question, Madam Chair.
Representative Drzewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has your agency, given the budget, the severity of the budget situation, has your agency entered into discussions about the logistical possibilities of combining county veteran service offices, maybe going with half as many as we have, and still being able to provide the same benefits? I appreciate any of your, kind of candid opinion around how that would or could or maybe couldn't work.
Ms. Keel. Madam Chair, Representative Drzewski, we have not ever engaged in that discussion as a department in my time there, because the CVSO offices are 100% county funded and county employees. So we don't engage in telling the counties how to run those offices. However, we do have a work group going on right now that Mr. Schoen is a part of that's not one of the questions it's addressing, but it hopefully we'll see with that report and when the work group concludes on June 30th, maybe somewhat of an answer to that question of if counties can cooperate, will they, how they can share services. But right now that's not been a topic that we've discussed as a part of the working group.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, at least in Nicollet County, our county veteran service officer is also our emergency management director, and I think they wear a third hat as well. And I certainly invite our previous testifier. I'm sure that our testifier has more insight on the workload of county veteran service officers throughout the state. Not to put you on the spot again.
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow. Milt Schoen, and I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. The workload varies widely. I mean, we've got counties that have less than 1,000 veterans. In my particular county, I have 75,000 veterans. The nature of the job varies. In a place like St. Louis County, you've got numerous population centers, both on the far southern part of the county, the far northern part of the county. We have a number of counties where you have this spread-out population where you have to deliver service to those people. We feel that, the level of government that's closest to the people, the county, it's important that, the service is delivered in that way. If you were, let's say, as an example, if you were to combine five counties, you might have somebody who does not live in the community, is maybe not connected to the people in the community, not aware of the nursing homes, not aware of some of the connections. And the knowledge of the people you serve is very important in terms of being able to serve the needs of your community. In many rural communities, we've got county veteran service officers that arrange transportation. We have people who will, northwestern Minnesota, they might even go to a veteran's home to somebody, and with the price of gas and somebody maybe being 45, 50 miles away, that's a very important service. In other counties, just the volume of the business demands that you are not able to afford as much time to each individual. But we think that the system has served the state well, and that we're able to access federal dollars and connect veterans to the benefits that they've earned.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? I just have one more question. Alexandria is building a, as I know anyway, a clinic for veterans. Do you know anything about that?
Madam Chair, after consulting with Milt, we think it might be one of the community outbreak clinics that the federal government is building, but we can check on that and get back to you. We definitely know it's not anything the department's doing, but we'll find out if it's a federal piece or not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The meeting is adjourned.